The deregulated electric market was set up to save money for Texas consumers, so why did Texans end up paying $28 billion more? That story coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. A Wall Street Journal analysis shows the Texas electrical grid not only failed during the storm, but failed consumers for decades by leading to higher bills. We'll hear what happened and why, plus the latest on hearings by Texas lawmakers. With the disaster declaration in the Lone Star State, what comes next? The nuts and bolts of accessing federal aid. The University of Texas RGV in hot water for turning away eligible people seeking vaccines. Plus, the week in Texas politics and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 26th day of February. Hope yours is a happy Friday so far. I'm David Brown. Should Donald Trump be allowed to hold office again? It might not surprise you, the findings of a new University of Texas, Texas Tribune survey. The question from the survey: did Donald Trump take actions as president that justify preventing him from holding future elected office? 45% of the respondents said he did. 48% said he did not. Little surprise that 84% of voters who identified themselves as Democrats say he did. 81% of Republican voters say he didn't. This is in line with the outcome of a survey done back in February of 2020, and it suggests the kind of hold the former president still has on the Republican Party in Texas. If there's anything partisans seem to agree on, at least at the moment, however, it's that something needs to be done to address a clear and present danger with the state's power grid. At hearings on Thursday, Texas lawmakers promised to get to the bottom of what caused the lights to go out for 4.5 million Texans, many of them for extended periods of time, costing the state billions in damages and a still unknown number of deaths across the Lone Star State. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has more on the hearings.
The story of 11-year-old Christian Pavan Pineda opened the hearing in the House. Pavan, bundled in blankets in a powerless mobile home, died of hypothermia in the middle of last week's winter storm. Abel Herrera is the vice chair of the House Energy Resources Committee.
This is why we are here, to answer why. In a state that prides itself in being the biggest and best, we couldn't even keep a young boy warm.
Answers to that question were labored, complex, and stymied by finger-pointing. Corpus Christi Representative Todd Hunter.
I want the public to know who screwed up. I think that's what people want to know.
In hours of testimony from energy executives, state regulators, and the manager of the Texas electric grid, blame was plentiful. The most important factor for why is power generators failed to stay online as turbines and coal piles froze, and the biggest factor, natural gas lines failed to deliver gas. Senators grilled Bill Magness, CEO of the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which manages the state grid. ERCOT has been pilloried by the public and Governor Greg Abbott in recent days and saw six board members resign as a result. But Magness was firm in his conviction that ERCOT did not bear the blame.
You wouldn't have changed anything in terms of your play calling during those critical hours?
As I sit here now, I don't believe I would.
In all, nearly half of the state's energy generators were knocked offline.
One of the key points here is weatherization.
This is the second Senate hearing Senator Robert Nichols has sat through about widespread power outages. In 2011, the state endured an hours-long event. As a result, state leaders passed a law requiring generators submit weatherization plans, but voluntarily winterize their systems.
Basically, providers are not required to implement any minimum weatherization standard or require to perform any exhaustive review of their cold weather vulnerability.
Last week's storm was exponentially worse in terms of temperature and duration than the 2011 storm, but Michael Weber, an energy system expert at the University of Texas, says in many ways it's a replay.
Like it's the same movie, but worse. And seems like we didn't even learn any lessons from 2011. Or so few of us learned lessons, there were very few solutions implemented. And it just makes us look like we're slow learners.
And he says that's just embarrassing for a state with so much energy potential. Weber says he heard several thoughtful questions Thursday, but also a lot of legislators politically posturing over things that didn't matter, like ERCOT's management.
Kind of looks like we're all yelling at the most visible player, but that's a little bit like the drunk looking for their lost keys under the streetlight, not because that's where the keys are, but that's because where the light is.
He hopes that as the process continues, lawmakers start looking for the real problems in the darkness. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
When it comes to finger pointing, deregulation has been singled out. The rationale for Texas's unique approach has been that it's good for consumers, keeping prices low. However, a new analysis of data by the Wall Street Journal suggests that central proposition behind our deregulated grid doesn't withstand closer scrutiny, so reports the Wall Street Journal, where Scott Patterson is a reporter. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We've been hearing a lot about how what we endured last week here in Texas has to do with the deregulation of our power grid back in 1999. Am I correct that the idea was this was supposed to mean cheaper electricity for most Texans?
Yeah, that's right. The justification for the whole process was essentially it will be good for consumers and result in lower prices, which makes sense. But yeah, we looked at the EIA data, and it turns out that's not really been the case in Texas.
What is EIA data?
Energy Information Agency. It's a federal government agency that tracks all sorts of things related to energy.
So you went through the numbers to find out if, in fact, what Texans have been able to enjoy cheaper electrical prices, right?
Yeah, that's right. We looked over a couple decades of data, looked at every year, and compared what people were paying in the deregulated parts of Texas to other parts of the state that have maintained their traditional utilities.
And so what did you find?
Well, we found that the deregulated parts of the state, people are paying a lot more. Actually, it comes out to a whopping $28 billion more over the years, which really jumped out at us. So we've actually been looking at this for a while, and then when the winter storm hit, we decided we needed to run out the story right away.
So let me make sure that I understand something. Were it not for deregulation, could Texans have saved $28 billion on their power bills? Is that what I understand this analysis to suggest?
It's hard to say that exactly if it would have been a straight up $28 billion. But I think it's safe to say that they wouldn't have been paying as much as they have. It seems like there's a pattern with these companies. The way that people in deregulated parts of Texas get their energy is they buy it from these so-called retail electricity providers. Mm-hmm. And they all compete against one another to supply electricity to consumers. And it appears that there's a pattern of overcharging some customers, not everyone, and there is a way to actually reduce your bills if you were very diligent about monitoring your payments and maybe switching between providers every now and then. But there are a lot of people that are paying a lot more than they should, according to the data.
I want to make sure that I understand something here, because competition is supposed to drive down prices. That's the very core of the argument behind what Texas built its system upon. So it sounds like what you're saying is that, yes, this works for some. This works for those who scrutinize where the prices are and are willing to track it and maybe shop around. But if you're wanting to plug in, get online, and have your power, and you're not willing to continually shop around, you could be paying a lot more for your electricity, and apparently a lot of folks are.
Yeah, that seems to be the pattern, that people sign up for a plan and they put it on auto pay and they just don't pay attention to it. And it's complicated. I don't think a lot of people look at how much they're paying per kilowatt hour and compare it to other companies. They just pay the bill. If it's going up, they think, okay, maybe I'm using more, or maybe power's got a little bit more expensive. They don't realize that it's actually companies that are just increasing the price. A lot of these companies have plans that start off at a fixed rate, which is usually pretty low, but they switch to a variable rate after a few months. And it's those variable rate plans that can inch higher a lot of times very slowly, and people don't notice it, but then a couple years down the line, they're paying at times, you know, 50% to 100% more than they would have, you know, at the initial start of the plan.
Is this a market failure? Is this something about the marketplace itself that is because of the lack of regulatory oversight relative to what you see elsewhere, that the marketplace is actually hurting consumers? Or does this ultimately fall to the consumers and an unrealistic expectation about how electricity is purchased?
You know, I think it's that's a good question. I think it's a little bit of both. You would think, you know, standard economic theory posits that competition should reduce in better prices. But there seems to be something different about electricity. And it may be that it's an essential good that people need and they don't think about it as a commodity that they shop around for. And there are a lot of people that do. We've gotten emails from a number of customers in Texas who say, hey, you know, I'm getting really good prices and I pay attention to my bills and I shop around and switch providers every few years. And I think that the companies probably need to do a better job of explaining, or maybe the regulators need to step in and try to educate consumers better. It's a tough thing. You know, it's not just in Texas. There are a number of other states that have similar issues with these retail companies.
That's the voice of Scott Patterson. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He and Tom McGinty have written an article on the high price that Texans have paid for deregulation since 1999. Scott, we'll link to your piece over at texasstandard.org. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Wells Dunbar is back monitoring social media on this Friday. Howdy, Wells.
Hi, David. Well, as lawmakers and Texans look to the future of the electric grid after last week, attention turning to regulation. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about the ongoing look into just went wrong, what went wrong, and who truly bears the blame. Via Facebook, Dennis Novak says the legislature is predictably using ERCOT and the Public Utility Commission to cover for their longstanding policy of letting energy companies operate with no oversight. It's better to have a few sacrificial lambs, he says, than take responsibility for your own negligence. Also via Facebook, Alberto Alfaro adds, I really hope judgment falls on some of those who need to be held accountable for the choices they made for the people of Texas. And echoing what we just heard about those higher electric rates many Texans paid under deregulation, author James Moore tweets us, how is ERCOT and the Texas grid's manipulation of energy pricing any different than the phony market manipulations that brought down Enron? Who learned from whom? Very interesting question there, David. Just some of the stories we're monitoring today, and I will be back with more perspectives from social media later in the show.
We'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, looking for you, and he'll be back with more of the talk of Texas in about 35 as The Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Tejas Storytelling Festival, online March 11th through the 14th, featuring over 60 storytellers, sharing the magic and mystery of storytelling and music. Tickets available at TejasStorytelling.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. With a pandemic slashing state revenues, state lawmakers were prepared for a budget crunch. Question they now face is how to close the shortfall without choking off long-term growth. As Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports, the solution is far from clear.
For the last 15 years, Sean Havronik has taught in Humble Public Schools. He's been around long enough to remember what happened to public education the last time the state had a major budget crisis, after the financial collapse of 2008.
All of the technology and instructional budgets were slashed, as well as personnel costs. So we had larger class sizes, no pay increases, and fewer resources.
So when Governor Greg Abbott said this in his State of the State message,
this session, we must continue to fund education as we promised.
Havronik was skeptical, and it turned out he was right to be. The proposed Senate budget may protect pay raises for teachers, but it also cuts more than $51 million from spending on technology and instructional materials. That's at a time when Texas schools have been struggling to extend virtual learning during the pandemic.
I spent well over $500 of my own money just to make the minimum requirements for online teaching already.
In fact, such cuts are what's expected this session, according to Republican Senator Brandon Creighton of Conroe. He serves on the Senate Finance Committee.
We have asked state agencies to reduce their budgets by 5% coming in, and the base budget that we have already passed reflects that. But the base budget is just a starting point.
The state controller's office says lawmakers need to close a near $1 billion shortfall in revenues. That's not a huge amount in the scheme of things, but that's only part of the problem. Democratic State Representative Donna Howard of Austin sits on the House Appropriations Committee.
One of the big challenges that we have is that the base budget proposed by both the House and the Senate is about $7 billion beyond what the comptroller gave us for our biennial revenue estimate.
So what are lawmakers' options? There's some money coming from the federal government to offset damage caused by the pandemic. There are also accounting gimmicks that would allow the state to push some bills down the road. After that, things get sticky. One possibility, Howard says, would be raising taxes, for example, by legalizing gaming or cannabis.
I also believe, despite what the governor said, that we still need to consider additional revenue.
Another possibility, use the state's rainy day fund, which holds about $10.7 billion.
It was meant to be basically a savings account that could be drawn upon when you go into some downturns in the economy.
But neither of those proposals have support from the Republican majority. Creighton remembers they dipped into the rainy day fund after Hurricane Harvey, but doesn't want to make that a habit.
I think it's important that the rainy day fund is reserved for one-time expenses. And if we did use it as part of our budget culture, we might become reliant on it.
That leaves one more option, deeper cuts, which means little hope for teachers like Sean Havronik that their classroom budgets will be restored, whatever Governor Abbott says.
I expected it to be cut, but it's the fact that it appears they may be trying to hide it and not admit that they're going to be cutting what they need to do, I find disingenuous.
I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. I know some listeners are wondering if you qualify for FEMA aid after the winter storm zapped power to millions of Texans a week ago. We decided perhaps we should ask FEMA directly. Kurt Pickering is a Texas-based spokesman for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. Kurt, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Good morning. Thank you.
What types of assistance is FEMA actually offering?
Damage to properties from the storm, which can include damage, say water damage from broken pipes, things like that. Now, the first thing to realize, though, is that we aren't insurance, and insurance is first, and we can't duplicate insurance. So the first thing folks should do is contact their insurance agent, who will put them with an adjuster and go through that process. Then it's worth a try, probably quicker if there's anything available, to check with the state by calling 211. Texas is a 211 state, and that puts you with charitable organizations, mostly United Way type places, that may be able to help you, faster than that, maybe than FEMA. But then the next thing to do is to register with FEMA if you live in one of the designated counties and had damage.
Am I correct in saying FEMA is a sort of a supportive last resort, or is that taking it too far?
No, that's correct. The first thing that happens when an event occurs that turns into a disaster is that the locals respond to it. Your county, your city, your local agencies. Then if it gets beyond their ability to cope, then they ask for the state's assistance.
I see.
And then in turn, if it gets beyond the state's ability, then the state will contact FEMA and request a presidential disaster declaration. This one started out with 70-some counties, and we're up with, there's an amendment this morning that adds more counties, and we're up to 126, which is nearly half the state now eligible for individual assistance.
Well, how do you know if you're eligible?
I would say that the best rule of thumb is to register. I would get the insurance piece done first, because we're not going to be able to help you until we know what the insurance payout is, because we can't duplicate insurance. We got to know what the figure is, or we can't handle it. We can't do that. But other than that, I mean, if in doubt, register, because that's really, you know, I can't sit here and give out anything that would tell an individual in a far-flung county that he or she is eligible, because it's too case by case. But that said, if you're obviously not eligible, you know, it would be better to not clog the system by over-registering.
I understand.
I guess the rule of thumb is, if you had damage and you're in a designated county, and that list, I mean, obviously it's too long to read in this conversation, but it's at my website, and I'm sure it'll be at your website, and it's also at FEMA.gov. Okay. So if you check that, in fact, if you go to FEMA.gov/disaster/, got a pencil, 4286, because that's the FEMA disaster number, then you can go there and see the list of counties, and it's always perfectly up to date.
Okay.
So, you know, I guess the short version is, are you in a designated county and do you have physical damage? Then go ahead and register.
You have to provide some kind of proof, pictures, that sort of thing, documentation?
Yeah. Yes. And we often get the question, do I need to wait to start my cleanup? And no, sometimes the damage or the situations left behind by a disaster are dangerous. It's not necessarily safe to have water on the floor in the house. So don't wait for your cleanup, but do, before you start cleaning up, take pictures of what happened. Those will be useful both to your insurance company and also to us when we do an inspection. But yeah, you want to get yourself into a safe situation as soon as possible, and that includes cleaning up. But yes, you do want to take pictures to document what happened.
These are important details, and we're going to have a list including links over at texasstandard.org. Kurt Pickering is a Texas-based spokesman for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. Kurt, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard. Be sure to appreciate it.
No problem. Have a great day.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Air Force One is set to land in Texas today as President Joe Biden makes his first trip to a major disaster area since he took office last month. He and First Lady Jill Biden will visit Harris County's Emergency Operations Center to assess the impact of last week's winter weather. The president will later speak at a COVID-19 mega vaccination site at NRG Park in Houston. Meanwhile, the Biden administration's newly confirmed Energy Secretary, Jennifer Granholm, says Texas could avoid the widespread power outages millions of residents endured for days last week by connecting to power plants across state lines. The former Michigan governor says Texas's grid would be more resilient, even though it would fall under more federal regulations.
And I think the country would welcome Texas being at least connected to the national grid in some way, shape, or form that allows for its neighbors to help. You know, we could send ions across the electric grid to be able to help in cases, in situations like this.
Granholm was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition today. The U.S. Senate confirmed her cabinet nomination on Thursday. El Paso is set to receive 25 asylum seekers today who had been enrolled in the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico program. They'll now be able to continue their asylum cases inside the U.S. As KERA's Mallory Falk reports, the move is part of President Biden's efforts to unwind the controversial policy which required asylum seekers to wait out their proceedings in Mexico.
Ruben Garcia directs Annunciation House, an El Paso nonprofit that provides temporary shelter to migrants and refugees. He says more asylum seekers will cross in the coming weeks, gradually increasing from 25 per day to 50, then more.
Individuals will arrive. They will be welcome. They'll be able to sleep. Very, very important and critical to all of these individuals, some of whom have been waiting in Mexico close to 2 years. In very, very challenging conditions.
They'll stay at the hospitality site for between 1 and 4 days, then join family members in other parts of the country. Small groups of asylum seekers have already entered San Diego and Brownsville. All must test negative for COVID in Mexico before crossing into the U.S. For now, only asylum seekers who were placed and remain in Mexico and still have active cases in U.S. immigration court are eligible to enter. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
COVID-19 hospitalizations in Texas continue falling from their peak in mid-January. State officials reported just over 6,700 patients on Thursday. I'm Joseph Leahy.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The University of Texas Rio Grande Valley is in hot water after its COVID-19 vaccination site turned away several people who were eligible for the shot. The university has apologized, chalking it up to a misunderstanding of eligibility guidelines. But in an already medically vulnerable region with mixed-status families and multi-generational households, community leaders say mistakes this big can sow the seeds of distrust. The Texas Standard's Kristen Cabrera reports on how the confusion fueled a community's call for accountability.
Never in his life has Jesus Diaz felt as embarrassed as he did Saturday.
Nunca. Nunca en mi vida, después de casi 20 años que tengo yo aquí en el Valle, nunca me había pasado algo similar, nunca.
Diaz, who is undocumented, waited in line for hours to get the COVID vaccine. Moments from getting inoculated, a clinic worker asked him to verify his information and provide a social security number. Diaz says that's when it all went wrong.
Esta textual, palabras textuales de la muchacha me dice, esta vacuna es únicamente para ciudadanos americanos y personas con número social.
He says the clinic worker told him he couldn't get the vaccine. When he asked why, Diaz says he was told shots were only for people with social security numbers and United States citizens. To be clear, citizenship is not a factor in vaccine eligibility, and providing a social security number isn't required. The Biden administration even released a statement encouraging anyone eligible to get the vaccine to do so, regardless of immigration status, saying, quote, it's a moral and public health imperative. So what happened with Diaz?
Anybody who gets vaccinated at UT Health RGV has to be inputted as a patient of ours.
That's Patrick Gonzalez, a spokesperson for UTRGV. Gonzalez says without being there, he can't verify exactly what was said, but...
And so part of that intake is to ask for your social, but it's not mandatory.
After the clinic found out about the incident Saturday, Dr. Michael Dobbs, chief medical officer at UT Health RGV, says he called and confirmed the correct vaccine guidelines with the Department of State Health Services.
Based on our understanding of previous available guidance, the vaccines were intended for people who reside in the region, and particularly for those, you know, who are Texans. You know, I'd like to own up that we made a mistake and didn't follow protocol.
Dobbs says the COVID-19 vaccine guidelines and messaging coming from government agencies can be contradicting.
Sometimes the messages can be in conflict, and I don't mean with a particular organization like DSHS. I mean with perhaps other organizations, you know, like government organizations.
Governor Greg Abbott's own messaging may be a part of it.
U.S. vaccines are for U.S. residents. Texas vaccines are for Texas residents.
That's Abbott at a press conference on January 28th.
You must be a Texas resident to receive a vaccine in Texas.
But again, proof of residency and U.S. citizenship isn't a requirement. And Diaz's case wasn't an isolated incident. Dr. Michael Dobbs says the University Vaccine Clinic has since identified 14 people who were wrongly turned away. Norma from Edinburgh says her mother was almost part of that group. She asked we only use her first name for fear of repercussions. On February 8th, her mother had a vaccine appointment, so Norma went along with her. At first, a clinic manager denied her mom the vaccine, like Diaz.
And then I asked her, you know, so you're not going to vaccinate undocumented immigrants? And then she said that the governor had said something about only giving it to U.S. citizens.
Her mom only got the shot after Norma pushed back. She says if she hadn't been there to advocate for her mother, things would have turned out differently. It's this confusion that is fueling the organization La Unión del Pueblo Entero, or LUPE, to call for change. Juanita Valdez Cox is the director of LUPE.
This can do a lot of damage in a community that already has a mistrust in these institutions.
The nonprofit wants UTRGV to make a proactive effort and create an educational campaign in Spanish with a clear message.
The vaccine is for everyone, regardless of immigration status.
And it looks like the university is on board. Wednesday afternoon, UT Health RGV sent a letter to LUPE saying it's committed to outreach. It also released a bilingual public notice stating no eligible person will be denied a COVID-19 vaccine based on residency or immigration status. Dr. Dobbs says inoculating as many people as possible will help the community get closer to herd immunity.
Viruses don't respect lines of nationality.
UTRGV is asking anyone who was wrongly turned away to contact the clinic and get rescheduled. For the Texas Standard, I'm Kristen Cabrera.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Routine screenings are essential, and doctors can help patients safely keep those annual appointments. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For many Texans, life has resumed to what has become a kind of normal during a pandemic. But a week after freezing temperatures brought much of the state to a standstill, many others still have no place to go. KERA's Alejandra Martinez reports.
When Kanisha Toynes' apartment flooded, she hurried, grabbed her kids, and hoped to find shelter. Her apartment was severely damaged due to water pipes that burst because of freezing temperatures. Toynes is a single mother with five kids.
They're heartbroken. They're scared even still now because they don't know if when we're going to be able to go back home or even if we are. And it does take a lot because when you have children, you have to be strong because if your children see you crumble or see you cry, and that's going to put fear in them. If mama don't know what to do, you know, what are we going to do?
Toynes found refuge with the nonprofit Not My Sons. The organization is housing families that have been displaced due to the winter storm. The city of Dallas does have a 211 number available for residents experiencing a crisis to call. But Tramonica Brown, the founder of Not My Sons, says that is not enough.
What do you do when you ask the city to help you and you're told to call 211? I had 600 people on my back. Calling 211 is not an option for me.
Not My Sons has provided housing to more than 600 families since last week's storm. But Brown is concerned funding will run out before families can return back to their homes. I'm Alejandra Martinez in Dallas.
The Texas legislature is about to spend the next few months talking about how to improve the state's power grid, but that is by no means the only part of the state's infrastructure that needs retooling. There are aging bridges, dams, wastewater treatment plants that need to be repaired or replaced, not to mention the upkeep that Texas roads require. In fact, when you start to look at the problem, it's a little tough to know when or where to start, which is why we are turning now to Augustine Verengia. He is a civil engineer from Austin and government affairs chairman for the Texas chapter of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Augustine, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's break down some of the state's priorities here. When you look at Texas's infrastructure, what would you put at the top of the to-do list? What are the most urgent items?
Yeah, so every 4 years, ASCE releases the infrastructure report card. Some of the key priorities that came up in this year's report card were some of the items that you touched on: wastewater, dams, levees. Wastewater scored a D. Dams a D+, levees as well a D, highways and roads a D+ as well.
That's not very encouraging. But, you know, you think about the fact that at the start of last week, I'm thinking maybe Sunday night going into Monday, not too many Texans were thinking about whether, say, Texas's power plants were winterized. And I'm wondering if there's something like that on this report card, something that may not be on people's radar at the moment, but could have a huge impact on their lives that, you know, we need to be thinking about right now.
Sure. I mean, infrastructure supports the activities of everybody's daily life. When you are driving down the road every day, you're experiencing traffic, you're losing time in your day. There's over 7,000 dams in Texas, the oldest one being over 170 years old. There are more than 3,000 dams around the state that are exempt from any type of safety requirements based on the Texas Water Code. And the estimated cost right now to rehabilitate dams in Texas exceeds $5 billion. We believe that Texas should require mandatory safety inspections and come up with public evacuation plans for areas that are protected by dams due to the potential for catastrophic failure and loss of life.
Then again, you know, we've talked about bridges, and we've seen in recent years where bridges in other parts of the country have not received critical upgrades to infrastructure, and there have been bridge collapses even during rush hour in some places. Are we in danger of experiencing a similar calamity in Texas?
I think that anytime there's a failure to act, the consequences are pending. And as long as we are still kicking the can down the road, we are still facing these risks. I think that most people can connect to the idea that if you take a bridge to work and it only takes you 30 minutes to get to work, but then that bridge is taken out of service, even if it doesn't fail, even if somebody realizes that it may potentially fail, it may add an hour and a half to your commute every day. And the impacts of that to people are very real.
But if I'm a Texas lawmaker and I'm hearing this report card with all of these poor grades, what do I do with that information? I mean, we have the events of last week, which seem to be a clear and present issue, priority, you might say. Is there something else that should be right up there on that list of priorities? In other words, if you were to try to prioritize things, I think most lawmakers are going to go for the power grid right now. What's number two, number three?
Sure. I mean, I think number one overall is that Texans deserve infrastructure systems that are resilient and strong. Our state is growing at a significant rate, and we're getting more than 1,000 people moving here a day, with the population set to double by 2050. And as engineers, we like to joke that when people are moving here, they're not unpacking new bridges or dams or wastewater lines out of their suitcases. So ultimately, there needs to be a significant investment put in place now to ensure that the state can provide for and withstand the impacts of this growth. Otherwise, our infrastructure will crumble under the pressure, and the cost to everyday citizens, to our public health, our economy, and our environment will be far greater in the future.
I'm trying to pin you down. What do you think is the number one thing then? Is it bridges? Is it roads? Is it water infrastructure? What's the number one?
I personally believe that one of the things that we face that's the most critical item would be wastewater infrastructure. Water resources are set to be very scarce moving forward, especially as we have more and more people moving here. Mm-hmm. And we are spending 30% more. Users usually cover the fees on wastewater improvements, and the cost of wastewater improvements has gone up 30% since 2016. And the failure to act on that is causing more and more sanitary sewer overflows, which mm-hmm. then pollutes all of our freshwater resources that we know are so scarce.
Each year, though, we get a middling to not so great report card when it comes to infrastructure. Do you sense that there's an opportunity right now for significant infrastructure investment, or no?
I believe that the need and the opportunity for infrastructure investment is very present. And, you know, ultimately, if we don't act now and we don't change our policy of being reactive to every time that there's a crisis or a hazard or an extreme weather event, we need to change our pace. We need to be proactive. We need to plan for these things, or else we stand to, experience some really devastating conditions
Augustine Varengia is a civil engineer from Austin and the government affairs chairman for the Texas chapter of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Augustine, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that routine colorectal cancer screening appointments are essential for early detection. Statistics show catching this form of cancer early often leads to a higher survival rate. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at TexasCollegeSavings.com.
I'm Naomi Shihab Nye, writing with my friends Typewriter Rodeo. They make up spontaneous poems on typewriters on many various subjects. Still Joy. One little boy asks what ghosts eat for protein. Candles? One little boy says he loves you more than all his toys. One little scrappy cat living under the vine gobbles your secret offerings at midnight. The children of Palestine light up your screen, speaking of their writing projects, sharing drawings, saying, hopefully someday we will all eat with our bigger families again. And those mountains of books teetering on the little table by the bed, on the floor, more books than you remember getting. Finally, time to read them. I'm reading six at once, depending on the mood of any hour. Why did we ever need to go places to have something to do? This is Naomi Shihab Nye with Typewriter Rodeo. You're listening to Texas Standard.
The Typewriter Rodeo airs each week here on The Standard, and it's powered by suggestions from you-know-who, listeners just like you. If you have a theme for a poem you'd like to hear, give us a shout on social media or over at TexasStandard@KUT.org. Time now for the week that was in Texas politics. Joining us is Karen Brooks Harper, Health and Human Services reporter for the Texas Tribune. Karen, welcome back to The Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Last week's winter storm understandably presented quite the roadblock for COVID vaccine distribution in Texas. From what you can determine, how did it affect vaccination rates, and how are things looking now that we've seen something of a thaw?
Well, it did drop the vaccine rate significantly. We were delayed about 450,000 doses that were supposed to arrive that didn't because of the storm. They are here now, along with almost a million more doses for first and second doses. So we saw about 1.5 million doses coming in, but it severely hampered the vaccine rate for about a week during the snowstorm.
But as I understand it, state officials have now put the Texas National Guard into deployment mode to help get some COVID vaccines out. What's the plan?
So there's about 1,100 National Guards members who will be forming teams to either go out and identify seniors, Texans 65 and older, who are homebound, basically, are unable to get out of their homes, and then also administering the vaccines to them in their homes. And that's going to be happening. They're going to be concentrating on rural areas, isolated areas, and it's modeled after local programs, such as one in Corpus Christi called the Save Our Seniors program, and that's what they've called the statewide program now.
I think a lot of listeners would wonder why this took so long to happen. I mean, why couldn't this have happened months ago?
Well, that's a good question. You know, we haven't gotten a lot of, you know, explanation as to how, you know, how things move forward on these decisions sometimes. I do know that part of the issue early on would have been vaccine supply. Now that supplies are ramping up significantly, then there's a lot more opportunity for the teams to go out and the providers to vaccinate more people. So I think you're also looking at a change in leadership from the White House having a lot to do with that as well. And yeah. So it's a number of reasons that are allowing them to ramp up their efforts now.
Not much time left, but the governor this week said an announcement is coming, in his words, pretty soon, regarding statewide COVID restrictions. What are you hearing now, and what are overall rates in Texas looking like?
The rates are all dropping. The hospitalizations is down to about what it was last August. And the hospitalization rates are really what kind of drive a lot of this. The effort focused on the older Texans and the vulnerable Texans is a way to immediately drop hospitalization rates, and they are dropping. And as more Texans get vaccinated, that'll continue to go down. We're having a drop in cases and an increase in daily vaccinations, and the nursing homes are experiencing a drop in deaths overall nationwide as well. So Greg Abbott is really considering at this point when to drop the statewide mask mandate. He's not committing to a date. We've been asking him a lot lately. And the most he'll say is a decision will be made, you know, pretty soon.
Karen Brooks Harper is Health and Human Services reporter for the Texas Tribune. Karen, thanks again.
Thank you for having us.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas on this Friday. Hello again, Wells.
Hi, David. Obviously, Texas energy issues top of mind for many folks out there still, and we're hearing from folks about Texas regulation and its role in the blackouts that we face, the same topic that our legislature is picking up again today. We got this tweet from Texas Helgi, and they note that similar to what we heard earlier about the higher rates that people pay on the deregulated markets where it's not one provider offering the utilities, he says, I have to look very carefully every 2 years or so for a better rate, and notes that he overpaid for decades at first. This, of course, in those deregulated markets like Houston, where you have a choice of power providers, you have to watch for rates and all sorts of different issues. Samra Jones Buffkins via Twitter, she notes that we should not forget that Enron was an early driver of electric deregulation. She calls to let that sink in, echoing something we heard earlier about bringing up the specter of Enron there. And Justin, a listener who has since unfortunately moved out of Texas, says that he misses a lot of things about the state, but the electric market is not one of them. He tweets that he's fortunate to live in a state that has 100% publicly owned power, and having that accountability to the voters, taxpayers, and customers is powerful, and also it's so much cheaper. And as I mentioned, the legislature drilling down into these issues again today, going to remain to be seen who's going to come out essentially on top here in this political battle. We have ERCOT, we have the Railroad Commission, we have the Public Utility Commission. Lots of folks live tweeting some of those events. I know KUT or Home Station, one of their energy reporters, Mose Bouchel, tweeting out some hearing findings. So lots of stuff, lots of moving pieces at play there today, David.
Indeed. And it'll be interesting to see what lawmakers ultimately come up with, right? I mean, if not the system as it stands, what then the replacement for the status quo? And that's something that a lot of folks continue to watch. And of course, we continue to keep our eyes on here at the Texas Standard. We'd love to know your thoughts. You know what to do, of course. You look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice, or visit us anytime 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. Our program is produced by Jill Amon, Kristen Cabrera, Joy Diaz, Alexandra Hart, and Michael Marks. Terry Langford is our editor. Leah Scarpelli directs the show, and Casey Cheek is our technical director. Shelley Brisbane, Caroline Covington, and Wells Dunbar are in charge of everything you see online. Rhonda Fanning and Laura Rice are our executive and managing producers. I'm David Brown, and on behalf of the entire Texas Standard team, we wish you a wonderful weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit texaspublicmedianetwork.com.